This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Katie Royfe is a professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University. She writes a column on life, literature and politics for Slate and writes for the New York Times, Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Paris Review and other publications. She is the author of numerous books, including The Morning After, Sex, Fear and Feminism, and Uncommon Arrangements, Seven Marriages in Literary London, 1910 to 1939. And her latest book, which we're going to talk about on the show today, is a collection of essays in praise of messy lives. So, Katie, welcome to Little Atoms, first of all.
Thank you.
You've got a... Well, the New Yorker once described you as a self-proclaimed bad girl and sexual rebel. You have a persona of a provocateur, shall we say. And I guess that probably started in 1990. You wrote a book... The Morning After, which looked at the 90s culture on campuses about sort of sexual etiquette and was seen as something heretical at the time. So let's talk about the reaction to that book, I guess, and what happened after you wrote it.
Well, it actually came out in 1993 in the US and 1994 here. And the book started, I was a graduate student in literature, and it started as I wrote a piece comparing the date rape pamphlets being given out to college freshmen with Victorian guides to conduct for young ladies. Mm-hmm. And I was just pointing out how the language of these two documents were the same and sort of condescending or infantilizing to women. So the book was very controversial both here and there in the U.S. And it was a time of very kind of, how can I put it tactfully, very strong feminist views. And there was a sense that you weren't allowed to dissent or you weren't allowed to say something that was critical of the dominant feminist ideology. And so the book was really perceived as, you know, just me throwing a rock through a window. And it was kind of an interesting experience for me because I was 23 when I wrote the book, so it was a bit shocking. But I wrote the book to kind of shake people up and have them think about things in a new way. And even though there was a lot of anger directed at me, I think I did achieve that goal with that book. So it was kind of meant to provoke conversation. People would say, like, you know, we got into a huge fight about your book at our dinner party, and someone threw it across the room and said, that was the kind of book it was. So that was, you know, it was a book that made a lot of people mad. And I guess that was the beginning of my career.
What was going on then? What do you think? There was obviously a, I don't know if crisis is the right way to describe it, but that was like a point in feminism. Obviously, these were different people to the first and second wave feminists that were big in the sort of 60s and 70s. Why was there, I guess, some sort of, crisis in feminism at that time?
Well, I felt that there was a kind of puritanical streak in American feminism. Mm-hmm. Where suddenly this idea of this lurking male sexual threat, if a man, you know, compliments you on your clothes in the office, they're like, you know, you're going to burst into tears. I felt like the assumptions behind this kind of feminism were really dubious. And it was really a certain strand of the movement in the 70s that was really about fixated on these issues of sex and on kind of using this really clunky political language to describe the much more complex, intricate, intimate things that are going on between people. And I felt that political language was sort of crude in certain ways. And I think the feminist movement, I consider myself a feminist, and I teach a class on writing sexual politics at NYU, and I teach writers like Simone de Beauvoir and Germaine Greer and like great thinkers of the movement. I think in the 90s, with this obsession with, you know, this sort of women and their sexual vulnerability, I think the movement got a little off track, from my point of view, from the initial goals of sort of equality and power and success.
So let's talk about your career in between Morning After and this new book, In Praise of Messy Lives. And In Praise of Messy Lives is getting sort of great notices and brilliant write-ups. I read a fantastic review in the New York Times of it, and I read it and absolutely adored it. I thought it was a wonderful book. But did you notice that book had an effect on your subsequent career?
My first book, yes. It took a long time. There were, you know, articles about... It became, as you said, I kind of created this persona with that book. And it took me a long time to kind of outrun that persona. There was an article in Esquire in the U.S. called Doomy Feminism. It was a cover story. And it was like, suddenly this phrase, doomy feminist, which is so appalling, was me somehow. And it took me a long time to what I think a very serious work, and I have a PhD in literature, and I felt like I'm doing this serious literary work. Mm-hmm. I'm not just trying to like be inflammatory or splashy. And it took a long time for me to do the work I wanted to do and to be respected for the kind of work I wanted to do. And, you know, to write about people like Susan Sontag and do more serious work. And I didn't want to be, and I feel hope that I have not become a kind of pundit. I had a fear and a horror of becoming, you know, newspapers would call me up and say, like, oh, we want the Katie Royfe piece on this, like, campus case. And I just didn't want to write the Katie Royfe piece. I wanted to do something more surprising or unpredictable. And so I felt a long time like I was resisting that path of being a pundit or a spokesperson. And it took a long time, I guess, of my stepping out of public conversation and just doing the writing I wanted to do and doing the thinking I wanted to do. I wrote a novel in between. I did a lot of work that I felt was just not related to, you know, not going to put me on television for a while. And I think that was good for me.
Well, you say you sort of tried to move away from that, but I think this book in particular, there are a number of essays. I saw a description of you, I'm not even sure I can pronounce it, as an uncomfortableist, which I think is a great coinage. I think it's a compliment, not necessarily a criticism. But there are certainly, and we'll get to those essays further in the interview, there are certain shibboleths that you have a go at in this book. You talk in the introduction to the book about how actually, you know, in real life, you're a nice, polite, self-effacing person. But this stuff comes out in your writing. Can you just not help it, do you think?
Well, yeah, I loved that phrase, uncomfortableist, too, because it's both a compliment and an insult. But I did think it captured something, which is just that I have always been in my career, and am still, attracted to subjects that make people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's a really perverse thing, because often, you know, I kind of wake up and I've written a piece and I'm like, and every, like, right-thinking liberal in New York City hates me today. And so that feeling, and it's a strange paradox, because I think everybody writes for love. Writers want to be loved for their work. So when you're, like, hated for your work, it's kind of upsetting and strange. But obviously, I have to admit that I'm doing it. On some level, I'm drawn to those topics. And on some level, for me, and I tell my students this when I teach writing, those subjects that make even you uncomfortable, I mean, I often think they're very rich subjects. So often I write about things where even I am feeling really anxious and nervous about addressing this topic. And I often find those are the best pieces, partly because I'm interested in the work of I call it in the book I sort of mention it, it's close readings of culture. So rather than close readings of poems, which is kind of my training, to do close readings of the outside culture. And I'm just interested in unearthing these sort of subterranean tensions, and especially looking at the language we use as a culture. Like, why are we using a word love child, for instance, and kind of teasing out what's really going on. And so I feel that the work that I do, which does make people uncomfortable, which does make me uncomfortable, is fundamentally to get people to think about things in a new way, to take the received ideas. We have a common way of thinking about something and to sort of turn it upside down. And for me, that's the most exciting thing about writing, is that idea of shaking people up and getting them to look at something differently. It's very hard to do, because most people are opening a newspaper, and, you know, I do a lot of columns from this book, you know, and sort of disposable prose. And most people, it's like you're sitting on the subway, the tube, and you're reading your newspaper, you have a cup of coffee, you're thinking about your lunch, you're thinking about your fight with your girlfriend the night before, you're not thinking about things in a new way. So the idea of this challenge, which is substantial, of how to get this reader with his newspaper and his coffee and his fight with his girlfriend to suddenly look at this something that they know or think in a totally different way, it's very difficult to do that. And I think sometimes it's sort of a violent process, like you actually have to like bother them or upset them or, you know, say something that makes them challenged in some way, and it doesn't make them like you. And I've sort of had to give up. You know, you never do entirely. You know, I write something that comments, like these vicious comments appear, you know, like bloom on the internet, and you feel sad because like people hate you. But, and I don't think you ever get over that. That said, I think I'm pretty immune to what people say about me. So I can get like a horrible denunciation in a big publication. And I don't really, you know, I'm pretty unfazed by that stuff by this point.
Well, you raised the internet there, Katie, and you write a number of essays in the book based around the internet. And I just was going to raise this idea that, again, sort of paralleling your career as a writer from the first book until now, we've seen the rise of the internet and a sort of democratisation of comment on the internet. And it seems to me that I'm quite pessimistic about this. I think the comments on websites and on blogs and on newspaper sites seems to have been a massive failed experiment in my eyes, because it really does seem to have brought out the worst in humanity. And you obviously can't have helped noticing that over the course of your career. And you say, you know, you're not that bothered about the comments, but I mean, this must have increased exponentially over the last few years.
Yes, I mean, I think what's interesting about angry comments is that what is revealed is this, the sort of raw response, and in the cloak of anonymity, kind of just how rageful and awful people are. And what is surprising about the comments is the rage. And frankly, the rage kind of aimed at me is not as surprising, because I've always had rage aimed at me in various ways and forms. But in general, at nearly any writer, there's just so much like free-floating, irrational, burbling resentment and fury. And it takes a million different forms. You know, and there are a lot of fantasies that people in comments tend to have about the writer, which I kind of unearth a little bit. And one of the funniest ones is that the writer is somehow becoming hugely rich off of their writing. The writer is like this, you know, polishing their Mercedes, as someone once said about me. And it's just a strange idea about somebody who's chosen to make their living in a career as insecure as writing. But that, I think, the new thing whereby readers can more directly, you know, kind of put up their reaction, I think you're right, it is sort of a failed experiment, because you don't, sometimes you get something interesting out of it, but you very rarely do. I mean, I can't say I read, for instance, the comments to my pieces, just because it would be too exhausting a venture, and I wouldn't get enough out of it. So I do think, back in the old days, when you had to walk with a, you know, put a letter with a stamp in the mail and put your name on it, you did have a higher level of conversation, because something about not putting your name on something frees people to just be horrible. It's like you're finding this expression of this dark collective unconsciousness of like all of a sudden these like really terrible things that are going on in people's heads. And I often wonder, who are these people? Do they live normal lives? Like, is this a school teacher who's nice to her second graders and then, you know, on a Sunday afternoon is like furious at everything? I mean, I guess you see a lot of discontent, people like just for whatever reason.
It's like an outlet then, I guess. You know, it's another way of getting, instead of getting drunk, or perhaps they do get drunk and then type, I don't know. But it seems like it's an outlet for people's frustrations, that they can have that anonymity. And as you said, work all week and then go on the keyboard at the end of the week and just vent their frustrations on somebody that, because it's the internet, they don't necessarily see as being a real person at the other end, I guess.
And there's a lot of violence in these comments too. Just like, not even just rage, I hate you, but even like violent fantasies, and it does make you wonder about, as you walk through the world, what's really going on, because it really does feel like some, you know, veil has been lifted on some like feeling that people have. So I think it is a bit disturbing, and I agree with you, it's not necessarily constructive.
Does that make it more difficult then for you as a writer to, well, I guess to reveal more of yourself? You write about critical essays about culture, and you know, you write things that certain elements of sort of liberal culture find controversial. But going a step further than that, there's a couple of essays in this book where you write about yourself in a not particularly flattering light. So, for instance, I'm talking about, there's an essay, A Beautiful Boy, Warm Night, where you talk about an occasion back in college days where you slept with a roommate's boyfriend. And it's a beautiful essay, it's very well written, it's sort of elegiac, you can sort of really feel that time coming through the words, but it reveals far more of yourself than I would have wanted to. Why did you feel you wanted to do that?
Well, I will say that essay didn't appear on the internet originally, so that's one thing. You know, that was sort of always was in print form, but I don't In my exploration of the idea of messy lives and of kind of unconventional behavior, I didn't feel it would be useful to kind of spare myself. And I felt it was important to include things that weren't necessarily, you know, flattering or put me, as you say, put me in a good light. And I felt it was important to use my own experience because in a certain way, this book, I think, was propelled mm-hmm. by a very strong feeling I had at a particular moment in my life where I was living very much outside of conventional life. And I did feel the need to investigate or interrogate the idea of not behaving according to certain social conventions, mm-hmm. and especially looking at sexual issues or women living outside of the standard modes of behavior. And so I did want to be honest about that. And I don't write a huge amount about, well, maybe I write a huge amount. I don't write, I felt that's not a big portion of the book, but I didn't want to be dishonest because I think one of the things that is, I don't know how to say it, like sort of off-putting is when somebody is mythologizing themselves so much that they can't look into some horrible thing they did, mm-hmm. you know, and I just felt the need to put that in there. But as you know, when you're asking me the question now and I can answer it, but I don't necessarily think that consciously about these things. Like I write, it's sort of that I write something that I feel compelled to write. And then it sort of is all part of something. It's less conscious than I'm making it sound.
I want to talk about a couple of the essays on the internet then. You write an essay on how Facebook is changing the language that we use and the way we interact. So infantilization of language, I guess, is how you describe it. So let's talk about that. What do you say in the essay?
Well, I was very interested in, especially looking at teenagers' use of Facebook and the kind of fictionalizing that goes on in Facebook. And one of the things I find, both the language, you know, the sort of debased language with like a million letters, you know, LOLLLLLLL, or the sort of emphaticness of everything on the internet, everything. I said it's like you're waving from a desert island for an airplane. It's like everything has to be exaggerated to a certain extent. I also find interesting just that people are so much inventing this stylized view of themselves that you can have a friend who you know is like maybe in a huge crisis in their marriage and maybe getting divorced who's putting up like family photos of how happy they are on their vacation and the story of how happy they are on their vacation, which is like this, you know, sort of how she wants to present herself to other people and what's really going on, that gap between those two things is interesting to me. And I do kind of make the point in that essay that I say like this is the novel we're all writing. Mm-hmm. It's like this total fictionalizing of our experience.
So the other one I wanted to take a quick look at was there was a article, well, there's always articles on Gawker about yourself, but there was a particular one that was called Katie Royfe is Big Immature Baby. Where is the A missing from?
I don't know why that was their hit.
So they wrote an article called Katie Royfe is Big Immature Baby. You've written an article called Gawker is Big Immature Baby. I guess perhaps very briefly, because I don't think Gawker's as big in the UK as in America, but we will have analogue websites, I think. Give us a brief explanation of what Gawker is. And I'd like to talk about the sort of Gawkerization of criticism, I think, on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, Gawker itself is, the Gawker idea is much more widespread and much more common, and I'm mm-hmm. quite sure you have it here, and probably even better, more highly evolved versions. Mm-hmm. It's a gossip website on a very high level, and it's sort of, the idea of it is to sort of very ironically take down people who Gawker doesn't like, who people Gawker thinks are famous for the wrong reasons, or, you know, celebrities they think are overrated, or writers they think are overrated, or the idea is sort of to make fun of people for their success. So it's kind of a Schadenfreude-type website. Mm-hmm. But part of what I think, the language, which is a larger sort of blogosphere phenomenon, which is a kind of irony, to approach everything and take down everything from this sort of dripping with sarcasm, this voice that's dripping with sarcasm. And my problem with that voice, with, you know, and the larger phenomenon on the internet, is that it's very, first of all, it's totally predictable. And it doesn't, it's very uniform. So it's almost like you could write a Gawker item on a computer program because you always know how it's going to sound. It's never surprising. It never varies. There's never any individual voice. So the individual voices of these bloggers all blend together because they all sound the same. So if you look at a website like Jezebel, which I think people do read a little bit over here,
sure,
which is the sort of girl version of it, or if you look at any of these type of websites, the voice is so similar that there's no individual kind of tone to it. And I think that automatic sarcasm, it comes very naturally to my generation and to younger generations, where you just sort of like sarcastically mock anyone who aspires to anything, anyone who tries anything. And obviously in the UK, this is a very familiar stance. It's actually very English, although our version of it is probably dumber. But it's a very English stance, and it's sort of the blogosphere idea, which is a knee-jerk irony. And I think the danger of it is it's not very, you know, for somebody to say, like, I'm trying to do something, or to be, like, sincerely making an effort at something, or to be earnest about something, all of that is totally frowned on.
Yeah.
And the sense is, I'm too cool to even try to do anything. You know, I'm going to make fun of these people trying to do anything because I'm too cool to try to do anything. And it is cooler not to try to do anything or aspire to anything or be earnest about anything or invest yourself in anything. But it's a little limiting as a life view. And I notice with my students, irony comes much easier to them than seriousness or than, you know, trying. And I think the problem with it as a way of analyzing or way of looking at the world is more what I was saying before, which is just that it's so predictable that you almost don't need to read it, an item. You know what it's going to say. I mean, if you look at Jezebel, you're not going to be like, I wonder what they're going to say about this issue. You always know what they're going to say before you even read it. So that I wonder, it's sort of an echo chamber of why even go through the ritual of reading this thing that you know exactly what it's going to say and the tone it's going to say it.
This also reminds me of, for years, I was a fan of The Onion, a satirical newspaper, and it got to the point where I started to think that everything that was funny about the article was said in the headline. So you'd read the article and you'd go, oh, that's brilliant, that's a great example of an Onion headline. And then what was underneath it was almost completely superfluous. It was like the joke was done, it was finished. And I think that has crept into serious writing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think, I mean, the thing about The Onion is it was like inventive.
Mm-hmm.
And is inventive. The satire is sort of for a purpose. But I just feel like there's not that creativity or inventiveness in a lot of these websites for in this bloggy voice.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. And this week I'm talking to Katie Royfe about her book In Praise of Messy Lives. So, Katie, at the end of that first section, we were just talking about the Gawkerization of the internet. I'd like to sort of widen that out a little bit. One of the things that the rise of the internet has seen is the rise of blogging and the sort of democratization, the lowering of the barriers to entry for writers. At the same time that this massive rise in published writers has sort of occurred, there's also this idea that the quality of the essay, of the literary essay, or of a serious essay that has something to say, is somehow at an all-time low. I wonder if you'd agree with that.
I actually don't think that's true, because I think people are reading a lot. And there's a lot of, I guess, we're in the midst of a transition, so the way people are reading differently, and people read things on the internet, or people read books on Kindle or Nook or whatever they're reading on. But I don't think they've stopped reading. And I don't think the appetite, and there have been a bunch of articles in the US lately about, you know, the sort of surprising vitality of the long form essay, because actually in various ways a lot of these newspapers and magazines are thriving that publish great essays or great work. And I don't actually think that, you know, people ask me about my students, like, do you notice that they're on Facebook and they can't read anymore and they have no attention span? But I feel like when I bring them a great book that's a little bit challenging, like a Janet Malcolm book, they still fall in love with it. So I think that the rumors of our death have been greatly exaggerated. Like, I just don't believe that I think that there's an adaptation to these new forms, but I don't think people really do want to read a great essay, and they still will, and they will eventually. I might be deluding myself, but that's what I feel. And I also think some of what's going on now is that the great writing still, or the very good writing still appears. It's harder for the mediocre writing to appear, and I think there's sort of a winnowing out of really interesting, kind of dazzling things from sort of boring things. And I think that there will be, you know, there'll always be an appetite for really good books. And, you know, even just people still constantly reading, like, great novels. And writers have always felt imperiled, like nobody is reading. If you read, you know, the criticism of 1950, you'll read like Dwight MacDonald saying it's the end of the golden era of reading. Or there have always been critics who thought we're losing the reading public, only three people are reading my book. And it's sort of true, like only three people are reading your book, but like those three people are still going to be reading, I think. So that's my view.
You go on to look at the sort of state of the sort of American cultural life and writing in some of these essays, and that we're going to get onto that. But before we do, and before we look at things critically, I guess I'd like to ask you what sort of things you admire at the moment. You mentioned in the first half writers like Simone de Beauvoir and Germaine Greer, and in the book, you know, Joan Didion and Susan Sontag, you write essays about. Christopher Hitchens gets a mention. All of those people, no, obviously Germaine Greer isn't. All the rest of those people are gone. So who do you admire that's writing now?
Oh, today. It's true that many writers that I admire are from another era.
Yeah.
Straightforwardly admit. I am a big admirer of Janet Malcolm, who's one of my inspirations and one of the writers I most admire for just inventing form. I don't know if you read her as much over here, but I think she's a truly original and brilliant kind of thinker and writer. And she's somebody writing today who I really admire. And there are lots of writers. I read a lot of fiction also, so, you know, I read kind of fiction as well. But I do feel like the essay is kind of alive and vibrant. And for some reason, perversely, when I think about essay writers I admire, it's, I am reaching back for dead people. But, you know, I teach a class in the long-form essay, and I teach a lot of writers who are writing now. So I do, I think the form itself is still quite vital.
So which of those writers that are writers of the past then would you say were the most influence on you?
I'm often, think I was very influenced by Mary McCarthy's work. She's one of the writers who is in my head all the time in both her fiction and nonfiction, the way she wrote about sexual politics even in, you know, 1940.
And an interesting life as well.
And an interesting life. And so she's somebody that is always in my head. I love Rebecca West, whose essays are underread now, I think. But she was a great critic and a great feminist thinker. And a lot of her work, if you read essays that she wrote in 1916, are incredibly relevant today. And she was sort of fierce and funny and, you know, just a beautiful stylist. And she sort of imported, as many of the critics I admire do, she imported the tactics of a fiction writer into her nonfiction, which always is kind of seductive as a voice. And she's one of the critics that has always inspired me as well.
I want to talk about one of the essays in the book now. And this is probably the most famous essay in the book. It was a cover story of the New York Times Book Review, the essay called The Naked and the Conflicted, which looks at the changing mores of the way that male writers write about sex. So, well, perhaps you can give us a summary of what the essay was about.
They gave me an assignment to write about American male novelists and sex, which is a giant topic. And I wasn't sure how to approach it. It's such a big topic. But I ended up contrasting the kind of old guard, the writers of the generation of Norman Mailer, Philip Roth, John Updike, with the writers more my age and younger writers who were in the same ambition and the same scope. People like Jonathan Franzen, Michael Chabon, Jeff Eugenides, writers who had the same ambition and sort of talent, and how they wrote about sex in contrast. And I tried to address some of the sort of charges against these older writers for being misogynistic and how I thought that was a little too simple a way of talking about it. But I ended up kind of, I guess, very sharply critiquing these younger writers who were sort of grew up in a post-feminist world, liberal education, who were so sensitive, and again, kind of subscribing to this ironic worldview, where to say that, David Foster Wallace, to say that you could have an affair and it would kind of change your life or transport you, or to view sex as something, you know, kind of desirable, was sort of uncool for them. And I used a lot of quotations, and I guess I sort of made fun of them for this overwhelming sensitivity and how, in a certain way, there's something sort of narcissistic and unappealing mm-hmm. about it. So the piece is, in a way, a satire, you know, of those writers. But I tried to just look at something that had changed in the culture where they were really kind of horrified by the Philip Roth, you know, just sort of like what they viewed as this kind of swaggering approach to sex and to women. And so the essay did generate a lot of controversy, which is a little surprising for a book's essay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen all the time for the book's essay. The Times got like so much mail, they had to print extra letters, columns. And I actually quote a letter in the beginning of the introduction of the book that's like, you were responsible to the editors, you were responsible for the destruction of civilization for this essay, which I, you know, was very tickled by. But it got people really angry, and I think I got like every male novelist of my generation to hate me, which was not my desire or goal. But it was controversial. I think it was controversial probably because it sort of did strike a nerve on some new attitudes we have. They're a little tricky.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask, you know, why the change there? What was the change was? But I mean, I guess at least some of those contemporary novelists that you mentioned would have been at college in the 1990s, right?
Exactly, so or even a little younger. Or they're a little older than me, so even late 80s. Mm-hmm. All that period of time. So anybody in college in the 80s or 90s was receiving, and by the way, is still receiving if you go to a college campus mm-hmm. today. So all the people coming after, and some of the writers were as young as in their 30s, and so they're all receiving this kind of post-feminist liberal education that is telling them certain things about respecting women. Now, what I tried to point out is that they're not really respecting women. They just have a new language for mm-hmm. disrespecting women, so that in a certain way, this sensitivity often masks just as much narcissism and contempt for their female characters. It's just expressed in a new way. And so that was, I actually quote a line that I love from Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, where he says, like, she was 32 and still beautiful, about one of his characters, and I just suggested, like, that is not the way in the feminist utopia that we would have our great male novelists write mm-hmm. about women. So I don't think it's like these guys are, I don't think this sort of respectfulness, which is very, and this sort of idea, this distaste for a more straightforward sexual kind of heroism that these other mm-hmm. older writers were subscribing to, I don't actually think it's about being evolved into a more, you know, like, better way of looking at women. I don't really believe in that. I think that there's a new language. And I was just interested in, like, what is our new language? And, you know, I myself find some of this, like, oversensitivity sort of irritating, which comes out in the essay, I think. But it's something having to do with our education. It's also part of the irony. It's also part of this idea that David Foster Wallace wrote an essay condemning Updike, in which he just talks mm-hmm. about how Updike has this idea that sex is this sort of imaginative quest. And ultimately, if you kind of scratch the surface of Updike, he kind of has this idea that sex is going to defeat death. You know, that the way that you kind of defeat mortality is to have an affair with somebody. Mm-hmm. And that idea is something that this particular generation is very suspicious of. That idea. And I do think there's a sort of conservatism, and this gets into the larger themes of the book, a sort of idea of safe conventional life that these novelists are subscribing to. So your current writer in New York City is married and is like going home to his wife from mm-hmm. a party and cooking risotto in their brownstone, and they are not doing the crazy stuff that a Norman Mailer or Philip Roth or a Dylan Thomas or, you know, male writers of the past were mm-hmm. doing generally. I mean, you know, I don't want to universalize, but I do think that the literary culture has, along with the larger culture, started to subscribe to this kind of healthy life and safe life, and that the suspicion of kind of anarchic sexuality in the work of a lot of these writers is part of that general phenomenon.
There almost seems to be an idea that, I guess, you know, since a lot of these, the older authors, have died. You know, there has been biographies of them, and I guess, you know, even at the time, you know, people like, you know, Norman Mailer, and there's a new recent biography of Saul Bellow come out by, mm-hmm. but you know, by his son. And a lot of these people, Updike, Roth, and I said Norman Mailer, they weren't particularly pleasant people, but there does seem to be this weird conflation of them and their work, and they write about unpleasant people. So Updike, you talk about this in the essay about the sort of the falling out of sort of the critical consensus of John Updike, this idea that people can't disassociate a not particularly nice person creating unpleasant characters, and almost, you know, characters should be sympathetic, which just seems a crazy idea.
I think Updike was very charming, actually. and I also think Roth, probably a great talker, and, you know, like, I don't know if they weren't nice people. I guess I object to that.
Okay, but there is this idea that, you know, we're talking about their work.
Right, whether they were creating men. I actually recently wrote about this in the work of James Salter, who's a novelist mm-hmm. that I very much admire.
Yeah, and who everybody is going absolutely crazy for at the moment.
I feel that his work, even this new one, has not gotten the attention it deserved in the U.S. Mm. And he's 88 years old, and he's written maybe his best book, and it's amazing. But there have been a lot of attacks on him for misogyny mm-hmm. in the U.S., and I bet there will be here that have been. And he often gets charged with writing these characters who, again, are in this old model of sort of promiscuous, and they sleep with a lot of people, and are they treating these women that nicely? And I did point out in this article, it's just not, to me, a very legitimate critical standard to be like, I don't want to marry this character. I don't want to have dinner with this character. This idea that you have to write likable characters mm-hmm. that you would want to have as your friend, I just don't think that's the most sophisticated or sort of fruitful way to look at literature, because obviously a lot of great books are letting you into the consciousness of somebody that isn't totally likable. And in fact, a book about a really nice guy might be kind of boring. Mm. So that standard is really puzzling to me. And it often gets applied to all these writers, and as I say, recently to Salter. And I don't even think it's true in general, because a lot of times somebody like Mailer, who responded to those charges in Prisoner of Sex, his great unruly work about this, he pointed out that some of these writers are not just taking on, he was talking about Henry Miller, D.H. Lawrence, mm-hmm. through the 20th century. They're not writing these swaggering sex scenes. They're actually writing critically about failures of human connection. So mm-hmm. some of what they're writing, they're not writing pornography, they're writing about loneliness, they're writing about lack of connection and sex, they're writing about these failed encounters, they're writing about these comic encounters, they're writing about, if you read Philip Roth, his sex scenes are comic, but they're also brutal, but they're also great, but they're also pornographic, they're all those things. And I think what they were trying to do is much more complicated than just, I'm so great, I had sex with this woman. I don't really think that's what's going on if you look at an Updike scene. Mm-hmm.
Going back to the, you know, the way that the later generation tend to write about sex, they tend to have this sort of modern, sort of liberal fastidious about it. But ironically as well, there's another essay in which you talk about the sort of vogue for writing about incest and sexual abuse. Mm. So why do you think when contemporary writers choose to write about sex, that's the route they choose to go there?
Well, that piece was more about the 90s mm. than now. And it was also about women writers. So most of the people in that category were women writers who were sort of subscribing to this fundamental fantasy of sex is always exploitation, it's always abuse, it's always horrible, it's always dark. That was very fashionable at that time, you know, in that period of time. I think we've moved kind of beyond that incest vogue, but there was a period of time where every new novel by a woman was like, actually, she was molested as a child by her father. And kind of what I pointed out in that essay is all these scenes were written in the exact same way, even writers mm-hmm. of very different styles, and quite accomplished, really great writers were also writing these incest books. So I think it's not an accident that at that period of time, this sense of, you know, this sort of abuse, this sense that like sex should be described in the most graphic abuse possible would be appealing to women writers of that period and readers.
Well, there was a massive popularity amongst readers for that thing, and not just in literary novels, but, you know, I don't know if it was the same in the US, but we had the rise of this, the sort of the misery memoir of you know, the worse the abuse the child could get, the more sort of popular the book was. And, you know, it was the period of time when we started selling books in supermarkets, and these were the books that would always be at the top of the bestsellers list. So that, you know, there must have been a sort of a need, an appetite for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so just to finish off this section, there's one other essay that I wanted to talk about in your section on literary life, and this is an essay called The Bratty Bystander, which takes a sort of swipe at the vogue for biographies of sort of minor characters in the orbit of major literary figures. And it does seem that there was a period of time when there was a sort of a trend for this. So, well, tell us describe what you actually mean by that first.
Well, there was a long period of time that I think we are still in, where the idea was to take specifically a kind of woman minor character and talk about who's connected in some manner to a writer that is very famous and a great genius, like, for instance, James Joyce. And in the instance I'm writing about, his daughter, Lucia. And the writer kind of suggested in that memoir, and this memoir is just sort of typical of the genre, that actually Lucia was sort of, she was the genius. And she was kind of somehow in some intangible way. She talks about a scene where she's dancing in the background while Joyce is writing Ulysses, as if the suggestion being that she is the one inspiring the book with her dancing, like she's the great genius behind. But she had to go crazy and she was in mental hospitals and because she was a woman and she didn't get to be artist, but he got to be the artist. And sort of this idea of this thwarted female figure who's really the artist, or inspiring the artist, or behind the art. And it's never very thorough or documented, because the connection is obviously sort of fantasy. There was a book on there, and there are varying degrees of responsibility. There was a more responsible book about Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre, which kind of implied that Sartre had stolen Simone de Beauvoir's ideas, that all his philosophy was actually coming out of her novels. And I think the more normal way to look at it, or the more reasonable way to look at it, would be that they were very close intellectual companions who fed off each other. But I don't think you could really say he was like plagiarizing her ideas. So some of this kind of biography, I think, also again is fashionable, partly because it's telling, in order to be an artist, you just kind of have to exist in the world. And that is an appealing idea for some reason.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Katie Royfe about her book In Praise of Messy Lives. So, Katie, let's talk about what is a messy life.
Well, the messy lives, the book actually started with somebody asked, kind of deadline random thing. Somebody asked me to write a piece on Mad Men. Uh-huh. And I was thinking about the enormous popularity of Mad Men in the US a while ago. And why do we want to watch these people smoking and drinking and like little kids mixing a Tom Collins and pregnant women smoking? And why is that so entrancing? People having affairs in their offices and drinking in the middle of the day. And part of it seemed to me that there's something about our current lives that are so safe, and this sort of preoccupation we have with healthiness. And something I felt, there was a sort of lack of imagination in the way that what we think is an acceptable life. If you look at parenting, if you look at marriages, if you look at people's romantic lives, this sort of structure we have created for ourselves, I think, is a little bit oppressive. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was trying to examine with the idea of messy lives, which is to sort of say maybe there's an advantage, not that we should go back to the days of Mad Men and be smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, but rather that is there something too conventional or too cautious about what we now define as the good life? And that was the question I was starting to ask with the book. And it came a great deal out of my own experience, because I'm sort of a failed conventional person, which I think is a very good way to put it, or like an accidental bohemian. I ended up having 2 different kids with 2 different dads, neither of whom I was living with. And I sort of found myself kind of outside of this world. And because of that, I was able to look at it, or I looked at it in a different way.
I think, as great as much as I love the literary essays in this book, and your writing about culture, I most love the eloquent way you write about the scorn poured on single mothers, basically, by society. And we have, I think, interestingly, obviously, you're part of a particular milieu, sort of New York literary culture. We perhaps in this country, when I talk about single parents, we'll be thinking about it from a welfare mothers type of angle, I think, because the single parents are always constantly a target of government sort of opprobrium. But let's talk about your own milieu in New York then. So tell us about what...
One thing I want to say, because I think it is true in the UK as well. I've talked to a few single mothers here, mm-hmm. so I'm feeling that it's true here as well. A lot of our fantasies and stereotypes of what a single mother is not actually what a single mother
sure.
is. And in America, for instance, 53% of babies born to women under 30 are born to single mothers now.
Sure.
So the majority. And here it's a very large amount as
uh-huh.
well. And so actually our fantasy of what a family is, namely two parents, two children in a nuclear family, is actually not what a family is
mm-hmm.
either in America or the UK right now. And you're right, there are a lot of class issues. But what struck me when I was writing the piece is that even in my world, where I think it's like this tolerant kind of post-sexual revolution, liberal, couldn't be more liberal,
mm-hmm.
educated universe, there was still this kind of simmering suspicion and stigma against single mothers. And I think that the fact that even in this world, there is this sort of prejudice against single mothers, which is borne out in America at large. There's a higher tolerance for gay parents than for single mothers
mm-hmm.
In America. There's a really strong suspicion of single mothers all across the country and in different places. And when I wrote this piece, and it's appeared in various forms in various publications, different pieces of it, I always get a lot of letters from women all over the country who are not in my little world
mm-hmm.
to be like, I'm really glad you wrote this piece because as a single mother, I feel... you know, X, Y, and Z. And I think single mothers in various circumstances experience the same kind of just really strong prejudice. And J.K. Rowling actually here has written, I think, really beautifully about this question. She talks about how people thought she was like lazy and selfish
mm-hmm.
as a single mother and all these ideas of single mothers and how depressed she was as a single mother. Meanwhile, she's like getting an education degree, supporting herself, trying to support herself, having to take care of this child and writing the Harry Potter novels. Pretty much the opposite of a lazy,
mm-hmm.
selfish person, you know, somebody who's really achieving a lot in that moment. And she writes about the disparity between this stereotype and what's actually going on in these households. So that's what I'm interested in that. And I've kind of become a crazy zealot on this topic. Like, I really am a fanatic for some reason, because I do feel like, and I see it all the time, where people are just apologizing for
mm-hmm.
their situation. And it's so crazy in our current, you know, because we live in this world where we can understand that, you know, like a well-loved child is a well-loved child.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating. Somebody said to me very early on after I had my child, and I was really getting a lot of disapproval even from my own family and, you know, as you say, like people in my social world. And somebody said to me, you know, you're really not living a dishonorable life. There's nothing dishonorable about your life. And I kind of burst into tears because it was such a revelation to me. I was like, and I realized I was thinking like, I'm living this dishonorable life, but why? Because I've had a baby on my own. And it was completely crazy, but you really internalize these messages. And that's why, that's where that essay sort of came out of, that place where I was sort of thinking, wait, why do I think I'm living a dishonorable life? Just because, like, there's not a man in my house.
Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the ways in which this sort of disapproval manifests itself there.
Well, I mentioned a few of them in the essay. Some of them are little word choices, like, when I was pregnant, somebody said to me, you know, you should wait and have a regular baby. And I was just sort of like, this is a regular baby. And somebody said to a friend of mine who's a single mom, like, you should wait and have a real baby. Like, why don't you wait and have a real baby? And she again was like, this is a real baby. So that sort of idea that you're going to wish away this irregular child, or there's something irregular about the child. And then that same friend of mine with the real baby, she went to a party, again, liberal Brooklyn writer kind of types. And she went to this party where there were a lot of kids running around. And this friend of ours said to her, I just want you to know Finn, her one-year-old child, is always welcome in my house. So you just know it's very chilling, because you would never say that to a child of married parents. You'd never be like, because why would a one-year-old not be welcome in your house? But obviously he felt he was being incredibly open-minded. He was trying to be nice. But that extending that welcome to that child, you just feel in those moments like you've come down from Mars. And so it's very you come to realize that people think, you know, and they pretend that they think it's bad for the children, but I don't, that concern is really masking some other kind of moralism or some suspicion for women who are mothers, but also sexually kind of free agents. I think the idea of those two things at once is very disturbing to us for some reason. So, and I think a lot of what's going on, we have Mitt Romney, you know, at the convention saying single mothers are responsible for our rise in gun violence, like just out of the blue, making this crazy statement. It's that kind of statement could be even perceived as an okay thing to say. It tells you a lot, even in the, you know, just one of the, our main two parties, about what you're allowed to say about single mothers. And I think the same is here, true here too, if I just read some of the kind of political characterizations of single mothers.
What I think is interesting, though, you also talk about the centrality in modern life of the child. There's an essay called The Child is King. And so I guess from the people that are living the what they would perceive to be the normal sort of mainstream, regardless of how liberal they are, you know, the sort of two parents and one child lifestyle, there's almost something threatening, I guess, from somebody that isn't living that same lifestyle, isn't putting themselves through the normal lifestyle, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I also, in that essay, recounted one of my colleagues said to me when he saw I was pregnant with the second child, he said to me, he like popped in my door and he said, you know, you really do whatever you want. And I got this really understanding that he was kind of saying, like, you're getting away with something. Like, he felt like I was getting away with something. And I think some of the people who say that or have that attitude, not everybody, but some, are feeling maybe discontented or bored in a kind of drab situation where they feel like they've sacrificed a lot to, in this new parenting culture, to kind of put the child, you know, spend their entire weekend on like taking their kid to karate and Mandarin and, you know, doing all these things. And the adult relationships are so secondary and they're spending all this time hovering over like creating a perfect environment. Cause we have this idea now that we, this fantasy that we can create this perfect environment for our children. And those who've like really spectacularly failed at creating that perfect environment are threatening because maybe your kid is okay. Like, you know, maybe like they look at my kid and they're like, actually, he doesn't seem like he's like losing his mind from this situation. So why am I doing, you know, it sort of causes all this existential anxiety. And I think there's something threatening, and there always has been. You know, if we look back to like Nathaniel Hawthorne and The Scarlet Letter and Hester Prynne, a kind of original single mom, there's something threatening about people who manage to do this thing outside of the normal conventions. Even though if people look at single mothers and think, I would never want to be that, I would never want to do it. Still, for some people, this idea that you're, you know, slinking off in the middle of the night to like a hotel bar with a man in nice dress and they are not. They're like home with their boring husband. So I think there's a little of that tiny bit.
It's interesting that, you know, again, a lot of these essays are written from the perspective of somebody who lives amongst a artistic, writerly, liberal society who no doubt would consider themselves, to, you know, to be on the liberal side of almost any opinion. But this is, it's incredibly reactionary, this idea, I think.
Well, I think I feel like I actually live in a really provincial world in New York. And that, right, it's people who think of themselves as really tolerant and liberal, but actually lack imagination. I think if I went to Berlin, and maybe this is just my, my own fantasy, but I know someone whose child was in a preschool in Berlin, and he said that of the 36 kids in the preschool class, like four of them had married parents. You know, they had parents who were living together or not living together or different situations. But our, just my child is in a school with like only married parents, straight married parents. And I think our, the world I live in actually, and the world, the statistics bear this out. If you go to a sort of small town in the South, there's less marriage, you know, with people less education. It's educated people are just kind of getting married and having kids and leading very narrow lives. So I do feel like there's a provincialism that's a bit surprising in my universe, but it, unfortunately, my universe is very influential because they're the media, because they're like people in big cities with lots of education are kind of influential in our ideas about things and in creating a cultural climate. So I do find that surprising.
Let's talk a little bit about the, I guess, the sort of tyranny of child raising, in that being a single parent is a huge part of this. But there's also this need to adhere to an idea of child raising. You talk about, you know, the crime of not breastfeeding a child, for instance, and making sure your children have organic food and things like that. And anybody sort of wavering from those seem to be sort of like evil in some way.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of ideas about the correct way to raise a child, but there's also this idea about safety. Like I bring up the example of a friend of mine who was going to a house in the south of France, and there was a stone floor, and she actually shipped for thousands of dollars rubber flooring, like rubber tiles, because she was worried her toddler would fall and hurt himself on these stone floors. And that's just an example. Obviously, that's a quite extreme example, but it's an articulation of this preoccupation with safety that we have, with this idea that, like, our children can't get dirty, and they can't, you know, you have to constantly put that, like, antibacteria gel on them, and they can't eat sweets, and they can't, you know, this sort of idea that we're perfecting and controlling every aspect of their life. And I think control is a big part of it. And I read this great thing written by an American psychologist, and she was saying, you know, we should really think about the fact that there should be more than 3 years between when our children are allowed to cross a street on their own and when they use their first condom. And I was thinking, there should be more than 3 years between, but is there? I mean, you know, that's, we're protecting our children to such an extent that they may be, like, not turning into proper adults. Like, I don't know what's going to happen to this generation.
Just to finish off then, because we're quickly running out of time, what would you prescribe for a more relaxed and possibly a bit messy life?
Well, I have no prescriptions because I don't feel like I've figured anything out. I guess my goal in writing the book was just to suggest that maybe it's okay to look at our current kind of received ideas about how to raise children, how to have families, how to get married, how to have relationships, and just the conventional, like, structure that we've been delivered, you know, from time immemorial, and look at it more critically. And to think about also tolerating people who are divorced or are single mothers or are somehow, you know, living askance of this, you know, dream or fantasy. And I guess to just sort of interrogate our very conventional notions of a healthy life, a sensible life, a balanced life, and try to think about the rogue advantages of the unhealthy life or the unbalanced life.
That's a perfect point for us to end. So I've been talking to Katie Royfe, and we've been talking about her book, In Praise of Messy Lives. Katie, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gavin Francis. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. And if you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.